thank you. Yeah, let me know if you can't hear me. I'm also going to try to stand on my tiptoes. Okay. All right, so as you all know, Lyme disease is the most commonly reported tick-borne disease in the United States. And although its range is spreading, it remains geographically restricted to the upper Midwest and the Northeast. In Massachusetts, Lyme disease is considered to be endemic in all of our counties. There are a few areas of higher incidence, including Berkshire, Nantucket, and Dukes counties. This graph highlights the burden of Lyme disease in Massachusetts. The incidence of Lyme disease remained relatively constant over the study time period, from between approximately 4,000 to about 5,000 confirmed and probable cases per year. From this, we know that doctors are consistently testing for Lyme disease. Over the same time period, we have seen dramatic increases in two other diseases, human granulocytic anaplasmosis, which I'm just going to call HGA going forward, and babesiosis, both of which are carried and transmitted by the same tick as Lyme disease. Between 2009 and 2013, the incidence of both diseases in Massachusetts increased approximately fivefold. Our data suggests that providers are ordering tick panels and looking for all three diseases at once. And this can be problematic because there is a large amount of asymptomatic infection with HGA and babesiosis, and it's not always necessary to treat patients based on laboratory evidence of infection alone. Because it can be difficult to determine if a patient with Lyme disease and laboratory evidence of HGA or babesiosis actually has symptomatic co-infection, because each disease comes with overlapping symptom profiles. So given all this information, and because of our dramatic increase in the number of HGA and babesiosis cases reported, we looked at patients reported between 2009 and 2013 with evidence of infection with Lyme disease and one of the other pathogens. We were hoping that we might see either epidemiologic patterns or symptom profiles that might help providers better identify those patients with symptomatic co-infection that required treatment for two diseases. So all three of these diseases are currently nationally notifiable. In Massachusetts, we have something called the Virtual Epidemiologic Network, or MAVEN, which was deployed in 2006 by the Bureau of Infectious Disease to serve as an integrated web-based disease surveillance and case management system. Reported suspect, probable, and confirmed notifiable diseases are referred to as disease events and are created through electronic lab reporting or manual data entry. Most tick-borne laboratory data is received electronically, and that is what triggers a case investigation. All the local boards of health in Massachusetts follow up on all the HGA and babesiosis events, and we have complete investigations on about 99% of our cases. Once an event is entered into MAVEN and the case investigation is completed, we use the CDC case classifications to classify the cases. Confirmed and probable Lyme disease cases with an event date from 2009 to 2013 were extracted from MAVEN and were matched to all the babesiosis and HGA events during the same time period by first name, last name, and date of birth. Co-infected patients were defined as having confirmed or probable Lyme disease with additional laboratory evidence of either B. microti or A. phagocytophilum infection within 365 days of their Lyme disease event. Symptomatic co-infections were sampled from co-infected patients and included anyone who had confirmed or probable case status for both Lyme disease or HGA or babesiosis. There were 226 recognized Lyme and HGA co-infections and 294 recognized Lyme and babesiosis co-infections. Again, these are the people with confirmed and probable Lyme disease and laboratory evidence of infection with another pathogen, and these people are at risk for developing symptomatic co-infection. We looked at the descriptive epidemiology for these people to identify who of them is at risk for symptomatic co-infection. Co-infection with Lyme and HGA occurred most frequently in June and July, and co-infection with Lyme and babesiosis occurred most often in June, July, and August. This tells us that providers should be more aware of co-infection in the spring and summer months, which is consistent with the peak period of incidence for all three tick-borne diseases. 72% of Lyme and HGA co-infections occurred in people 40 to 79 years old, and 45% of Lyme and babesiosis co-infection occurred among people 50 to 69 years old. This tells us that providers should consider co-infection in patients 40 years and older. I do want to point out that these results may be biased by testing pattern, since younger patients are less likely to become sick from babesiosis or HGA infection and may be tested for these diseases less frequently. So during this analysis, we first mapped our symptomatic co-infected cases, but realized what we really wanted to do was show healthcare providers where geographically the risk of co-infection was greatest by showing overlapping incidence of single infections. In this map, we showed the overlapping incidence of Lyme disease with HGA. The highest overlapping incidence occurred in Nantucket, Middlesex, and Berkshire counties. We created the same map for Lyme disease and babesiosis. The highest rates of overlapping infection occurred in Dukes and Nantucket and Middlesex counties. Note that when we compare our maps from identified co-infected cases with these maps showing areas of greatest risk, the patterns are consistent with each other. So now that we know who is at risk for symptomatic co-infection, I want to describe the people that we know had symptomatic co-infection. So as a reminder, the symptomatic co-infections were sampled from the co-infected patients, and they included anyone who had a confirmed or probable case status for both Lyme disease and HGA or babesiosis. So 31% of the Lyme HGA co-infected patients had Lyme HGA symptomatic co-infection, and 58% of the Lyme babesiosis co-infected patients had Lyme babesiosis symptomatic co-infection. The greatest proportion of HGA cases with Lyme disease symptomatic co-infection occurred in children less than 10 years of age and adults over 80. 5% of patients 40 years and older with confirmed or probable HGA had Lyme disease symptomatic co-infection. And only 0.5% of patients in this age group with confirmed or probable Lyme disease had HGA symptomatic co-infection. This low percentage is the result of the much greater numbers of Lyme disease cases compared to HGA. Reported signs and symptoms of Lyme disease include arthritis, cardiac abnormalities like AV block palpitations, also neurological manifestations including Bell's palsy, paresthesia, and visual and cognitive impairment, and rash and headache. Reported signs and symptoms of HGA include gastrointestinal illness, headache, fever, fatigue, joint pain, and muscle aches. Reported cases with Lyme disease and HGA symptomatic co-infection were statistically more likely to report joint pain, palpitations, fatigue, chills, abdominal pain, paresthesia, and cognitive impairments than patients with either Lyme disease or HGA alone. The largest proportion of Lyme and babesiosis symptomatic co-infections occurred in children less than 10 years of age. 15% of patients 50 years and older with confirmed and probable babesiosis had Lyme disease symptomatic co-infection, while only 1% of patients in this age group with confirmed or probable Lyme disease had babesiosis symptomatic co-infection. Again, that's a result of our excess burden of Lyme disease in the state. Reported signs and symptoms of babesiosis include joint pain and muscle ache, fatigue and malaise, fever, headache, and gastrointestinal symptoms. Patients with Lyme disease and babesiosis symptomatic co-infection were statistically more likely to report joint pain, cardiac manifestations, muscle pain, and headache than were patients with either Lyme disease or babesiosis alone. So there are a few limitations to this that I would like to address. First, Lyme disease is underreported to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. So this could have led to an underrecognizing of the amount of co-infections, either symptomatic or asymptomatic. Also, the one-year time period between matched cases is something I'd like to address. So we might be including patients who actually had two separate exposures and diseases. And third, the possibility of different lab testing patterns for children and adults. So published data on this topic are limited, but one thing that stood out about our data compared to the published literature is that while people with symptomatic co-infection did have an increase in some reported symptoms, compared to patients with one disease, we did not see an increase in hospitalizations among people with symptomatic co-infection. So from this, we were able to create summaries of these findings that were geared towards medical providers. So this might be a little hard to see, but this is our Lyme disease babesiosis co-infection summary. So we were able to highlight the demographic and geographic profiles for patients that are co-infected and at risk for symptomatic co-infection. And this is our HGA and Lyme disease co-infected summary. So I want to thank the following people for their continued help and support, and thank you. Yeah.
Do we have any questions for Virginia? Yes, ma'am. Come right on up. Hi, thank you for that, Joanna Buffington, Cape Cod, Barnstable County, Cape Cod. Could you just clarify when you showed the map of the hotspots, was that by residents or by where people were exposed? The previous speaker said that too. So that's residents. Because I was surprised to see that hotspot around Boston. Maybe they all went to Nantucket. So.
Maybe.
Hey, Roundtable, because that I'm not asking a question, I'm actually responding to that. So it's a reasonable question, and you know, obviously this is a problem with all tick-borne disease where we're tracking, where most diseases where we're tracking by residents, not place of exposure. But this Middlesex thing is actually real. Yeah, we're pretty sure. I mean, if you look actually at the landscape and kind of the, you know, the people who live there and the houses and green spaces and everything, it's actually totally sensible that we have a lot of tick-borne disease there. So you don't get to claim credit for all those cases.
Is your summary posted on your website, or can you share that with them?
Yes, they should be by now, right, Dr. Brown?
Or maybe.
Okay. Yes, we are in the process of putting those on our website.
Does anyone else have any questions for Virginia?
Jefferson Jones from Arizona.
Hi.
Did you have, what was your kind of recommendations to providers about using the tick panel? It sounded like before you were a little unsure about whether you wanted them to test that some are asymptomatic. Are you currently, do you put a recommendation to only use for high risk populations, or is there any blanket recommendation to always use a tick panel if?
You know, we generally don't give recommendations to providers in terms of, you know, how they choose to test or treat a patient. I'm not sure if Dr. Brown has anything else to add about that, if we actually would recommend something different.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, so our state epi and the other infectious disease physicians we have in the Bureau are generally not supportive of using a panel for testing. They feel like that you should really evaluate the patient individually and based on symptoms, use the appropriate test. But the fact is, when you look at our data, we absolutely know that providers are using panels. There's no question about it. So I think we're stepping away from coming down with a recommendation about it and just acknowledging that this is the practice, and therefore here is information based on that practice that you can use to more effectively decide whether you're going to treat your patients or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Does anybody else have any questions for Virginia? I have one.
Okay.
That's all right. I was wondering if, in addition to co-infections, did, and then you may not have collected this data because this obviously was enough work. But did you see any patients or any patients in any age range that had any striking comorbidities along with it may have made them more susceptible to clinical illness or maybe more susceptible to a co-infection? Didn't know if.
No, I mean, because the only thing we really looked at was for these three disease reports, yes. Unfortunately. So, you know, we wouldn't know if they had anything else that might be influencing this.
Okay.
Gotcha. Just want to ask the obvious, and that is, were there any Babesia and Anaplasma co-infections? And if so, how severe was the illness?
You know, that actually, I had a number four, and I didn't bring it with me. So I can actually get back to you about that unless, and I keep referring to Dr. Brown, and I feel bad about it, unless she knows off the top of her head, but I do not. Okay, you know, I'll definitely get back to you with that.
Anyone else? Going once, going twice. All right. Well, thank you, Virginia.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.